Hey, everybody, and welcome to Connectivity, episode 287. Back after a week off. Thanks, Alex's, for replacing us temporarily. Back from a week off, it's me, your host, Neil Ronahan. Joined, as always, except for last week when we weren't here, my co-host, John Raritan.
I mean, technically, I joined you exactly as often as you were here.
That is true. So as always, you're here. Yeah. Except for the weeks that I missed. Like, so I guess.
Yeah, I need to take some weeks off and make you do it by yourself.
Yeah, that sucks. As long as I don't have to edit, that's fine with me.
When your kids grow up, I'll have you do this by yourself because we'll still be doing it.
That's very optimistic. I appreciate it. Although at this point, Connectivity in some form or another is like over 10 years old. Or is this right? This might be right around the newscast 10th anniversary.
It's today.
Oh, no. 12th. Is it? Yeah, 2009. I think Connectivity might have started in 2011. So, yeah, Connectivity's 10th anniversary, I think.
We'll say it's today.
There is a chance it might literally be today. When someone else is talking, I'm going to go double check that.
There's about a 1 in 365 chance that it's today, yeah.
But it might have been like summer of 2011 that happened.
Okay.
But anyway, we should introduce our guest who's here to talk to us about the hot new Suda 51 game. That is Matt Zwodniak.
That's me.
Yeah. So I guess let's get right down to business regarding that so that way I can check this whole anniversary shenanigans.
Getting right into it.
Me and Neil are going to log off. You go ahead.
Yeah. Mm. So as we're recording, No More Heroes 3 is 2 days away from release. After some hullabaloo, the reviews will be out basically when the game's live in North America. And Matt, you have played No More Heroes 3. And
yes.
You are also not a big, you have not played the first two No More Heroes, correct?
Yeah, which is like kind of the thing I've been afraid of people like finding out for a while.
Sorry.
Thanks for outing him, Neil.
I'm a fake No More Heroes fan. I tried the first one like when it was brand new on Wii, and I can't even remember why I stopped playing it or what I thought of it. And then I just like was aware of No More Heroes over on the side for a while until this one started to come out, and I played the entire thing start to finish now, and I feel like this anxiety of like, should I know more about this? Because people talk about this and they say this franchise and it's like, yeah, sometimes it's bad on purpose. And I'm like, is that what's going on? So like the game, to my understanding, I tried to do like at least some research on the previous ones, and I like had the wiki open on the side so like I would be familiar with characters as the game's going on. The game kind of returns to the style of the first one where it's there's this open world map and you need to go around the map and complete a series of tasks and then get enough money so that you can enter, so you can register for the next fight in the worldwide assassin rankings. Although this time it's like the galactic assassin race rankings.
You go into space.
There are occasionally aliens in this game. And so my understanding is that the second game sort of streamlined that, and instead of an open world, made it like an overworld map. And the tasks you were doing are like these cute little NES style games. And this one's back to, it's like, you know, if you're lowing them on, you're doing full on lawn mowing here.
You definitely said lowing them on. I wanted you to appreciate it because like you never acknowledged it. And I thought it was incredible.
You know, sometimes that just happens. When it comes to No More Heroes, maybe that's just what it's called. And
yeah.
I never noticed.
Yeah,
it could be.
I mean, yeah, it could be in between saving by going to the bathroom.
Yes, that happens.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, I mean, I've played the first two No More Heroes. It's been a very long time since I played them because I played them back in the day on Wii. But like, yeah, I do remember how the second one kind of streamlined it. But in streamlining it, I feel like it lost a little bit of the charm. So I can kind of see the logic of going back to what they did in one, but I think from talking to you a little bit, it seems like maybe they didn't do a good job of kind of mixing the worlds of one and two together with making like mowing lawns or lowing mons, as,
yeah,
as
mowing mons.
The kids say.
That's the name of the episode now, by the way, just so immediately.
So I'm not sure how it was in the first game, but specifically how it goes is that before you have to worry about the entry fee, which you do know up front, so you can be like, oh, here's how much money I need. You need to do, I forget the exact term that they use, but it's basically just combat missions. And there's like combat missions on specific points of the map where they give you a general area that it's in, and then you go there and you need to find it. And the act of finding it kind of sucks because the overworld runs at like 20 frames per second and the pop-in is really bad. Ooh. And the overworld is also kind of looks ugly. But then once you find this match, it's just like a match with some random enemies. It's not literally random, but it's just like the regular enemy types that can show up, because this game does not have linear levels before the boss fights. It has these fights instead. So you do these fights, which I would say are decently difficult. Some of them are basically mini bosses, and then some of them end in 5 seconds. Then there's no way to know how difficult it's going to be until you're already fighting it. And then once you've done those fights, then as soon as you have the money for the entry fee, you can go straight into the boss fight, and the boss fight begins immediately. And if you need to get money for the entry fee, that's where the more mundane jobs come in, like literally lowing them on, unclogging public toilets, cleaning up swamp water that has alligators, going into the mines. And I think that's all of them. I might be missing one or two, but I think that's all of the ones that I played. And so those are like where the joke of like, oh, it's this hyper violent action game, and then in between it, you got to do these boring things that are really tedious and stuff. And that joke's funny. I like that joke. But at a certain point, it stops feeling like a joke and starts feeling like filler for playtime, because I can only mow the same lawns so many times. Like, I mowed like 7 lawns over the course of the game, and they never really changed. Like, maybe the exact layout of the tall grass that I needed to mow changed around, but I don't. How am I supposed to know that?
Yeah, it seems like even if it were to change, it's not like the action is really all that different.
Yeah. And it wasn't so bad, because I never felt like I needed that much money from them. Like, I could usually just do like 2 or 3 jobs and then I'd have enough for the entry fee. But like all of this combined together, where it's like the regular fights that you need to do for like to unlock the boss battle feel aesthetically bad, which is weird, because like I really love the combat. Which I'll talk more about that in a minute, because I kind of want to separate into part one, the bad stuff, part two, the good stuff. But like the fights, even though I really love the combat, it's like the same generic backgrounds for an arena, and then the same, like, there's like 9 enemy types just over and over and over and over again, and there's no dialogue or stylings or any of them. I remember in playing No More Heroes 1, that in that linear level leading up to a boss fight, it was like in a baseball arena and there were like,
yeah,
baseball players. It's
so
like that's,
there's none of that. It's basically like the same kind of level setup for
every boss fight. There is none of that. Occasionally like it'll be a different arena, like this time you're in a backyard, this time you're in a parking lot, this time you're in the alien spaceship, but
it's just window dressing.
Yeah. And like there's no coherent theme to what you're doing in this section. So these pre-boss segments feel very monotonous, because they're effectively identical for all 10 chapters of the game.
Ugh.
The only thing that changes is like the difficulty and intensity and the specific area on the overworld map that you're in. And that's where I feel like I get it. Like, people say Suda51 sometimes does things bad on purpose because that's the point, that's the joke. But this doesn't, doesn't feel purposeful. This feels like filler.
Yeah, this also, it also feels like probably dealing with a lower budget. I think like No More Heroes 3 was a thing that like had to take a lot of luck to even happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it took a ill-received spinoff that I actually kind of enjoyed in Travis Strikes Again, and like it's been a decade yeah. plus since No More Heroes 2. I think No More Heroes 2 was like 2010 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's been a very long time since the second game and the third game in the series, the third numbered game at least, is finally out. Like that usually if there was a lot of money to throw around for a No More Heroes 3, this game would have happened a lot sooner. And it mm-hmm. seems like, you know, using Unreal, which I think that, yeah, that's what they used for this. But yeah, I'm not going to say
it was some generic engine.
Yeah, like they're using a game engine for it. But and I think with that, it's like you're trying to make that game and you might not have all of the resources in the world. And it feels like that is something that is making this game feel more monotonous and repetitive than even the joke is supposed to be of being monotonous and repetitive.
Mm-hmm. It is Unreal Engine 4, by the way.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and that's because that's the thing, is that like part of what I remember about No More Heroes 1 and 2 and what I enjoyed about them was, I mean, there's the flair of the story and everything, and the combat in and of itself is generally pretty fun, but it was also like, yeah, like having the baseball arena to go to, having variety in levels and enemies and like different weirdo boss fights, like that was a lot of the appeal of that game. And if you're kind of making a lot of that feel the same, then it, to like, this is a game that I, it should be appealing to me. Like I enjoyed No More Heroes 1 and 2 years ago. I enjoyed Travis Strikes Again, and I'm kind of looking at it and I don't think I'm going to get No More Heroes 3. And it feels weird to say that, being that I've kind of liked everything else in the series.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like, sort of to transition into the things that I liked, like, so the things that I feel like were weird or uneven, it's like, so this is a big, dumb action series. And it's like, I know it has like more serious emotional moments sprinkled throughout. But like, for the most part, these games are silly, and they're known for how over the top and dumb they get. This is the only game that I've ever played where the characters are discussing a real life actor, and then the next line of dialogue is, he should be in the MCU. that was new. And there are some parts of the story and the theming, because when you get into a boss fight, then you can have theming. There are some parts of that are like ridiculous and kind of cool. There's like an entire section that's a horror game. And like that was weird and wild and interesting. Then there's like a boss fight where it's like, this is the musical chairs champion of the galaxy. Can you guess what you're going to do?
Moalan?
Yeah, I mean, given what you've said.
Yeah. So it's like those things are really cool. And then like half the boss fights in the game are, it's like, okay, here's like a 5-minute cutscene introducing you to this alien, letting you know like what they're about, what their relationship to the main villain is. And then another character kills them and you fight that character instead. Like it's really inconsistent with whether it keeps up this cool over the top style. And like sometimes I'm like, this is awesome, this is ridiculous, I love this. And sometimes it's like, wow, this fight kind of sucks. And isn't even visually interesting.
I mean, that honestly, that kind of, I just went and glanced at my Travis Strikes Again review. And that's the same kind of thing, is that it goes between these different kind of like different game worlds. So it kept up a lot of gameplay variety and had a lot of goofy stuff there. But then every now and then, one of them would just be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And like them would last way too long. And so yeah. It seems like that same kind of design philosophy got carried through to making No More Heroes 3.
Yeah, and I just don't know what to make of some of like the boss fights, because of that thing where it's like sometimes they go for the crazy over the top thing, and sometimes it's just a letdown. And there's never like a moment where I feel like there's actually a story going on. It just kind of feels like things are moving forward, and I feel like this doesn't feel right. This feels like, hey, I clapped when I recognized it. There's a lot of characters from previous games here. But what's actually happening? Not a lot. And that brings me to the stuff that I actually really liked. which is to say the combat in this game is incredible. Wow. Some of the best combat I have ever played in a game, legitimately. I think this is new. In addition to like all of the sword movements that Travis has, and you need to manage your charge meter and then recharge your sword, there's also a set of cooldown abilities. Is that new?
There were cooldown abilities in Travis Strikes Again. It has been a very long time since I played the first two.
Okay. And these cooldown abilities, like what they are, is that one of them is a rushdown attack. Like you teleport straight to an enemy and then kick them in the face. One of them is a big AoE attack where it just like creates the circle and everything inside. It gets hurt for a little while. One of them slows down time. And then the other one is like a force push. And the force push, it's like, I'm really happy that it works on boss fights, because that's the kind of thing where it's like, that's never going to work on a boss fight. And in No More Heroes 3, it works on all of them.
Yeah.
So like, they didn't chicken out on that. These are cool abilities. The combat is just so kinetic with these abilities, because whenever there is not an enemy directly in front of you, you can use your cooldown abilities to do something with the others. You can rush to them. You can throw them against a wall. You can slow down times that you can have, that you can just have the ability to kind of control the fight. It's so cool and kinetic. And whenever you stun an enemy, then you can do the wrestling move to instantly recharge your batteries. And you also can't button mash, which like I think is a really good thing. If you button mash, then there's like a buffer. So it's like if you hit three buttons really fast, you have committed to those three buttons. You're going to do those attacks no matter how long the animations take. And I really like that, because it means you need to be very thoughtful about combat. And if you're just mashing buttons, then like the enemy is going to get stunned and you're not going to be able to do anything about it, because Travis is going to hit them and unstun them. So the combat forces you to think about the individual moves that you're doing at this incredibly fast pace. And that's incredible. I love that, because usually fast paced action games are just button mashers and then you can just do whatever you want. This one doesn't let you do that. And I think that's really cool, because combat just feels so satisfying when you finally pull it off. You can probably like just hear in my voice right now how excited I am thinking about this combat. And that's why this game feels so weird to me, because I started this with like a 20 minute rant on how this game just sucks. And now I'm here like, this is the best thing ever. And I'm at like a philosophical quandary right now. Like, we're recording on Wednesday. The review's coming out on Friday. I haven't written the review yet. And I philosophically need to decide, like, how does this balance out? How do you
weight it?
Like, when 40% of the game is like a legitimate 10 out of 10 and that other 60% of the game is like a 3 out of 10, what do you do? And I don't know the answer to that.
It almost feels like, I mean, one, this game probably would have been better if it was just the combat, maybe with at least like less interstitials.
You want No More Warriors, which is a great title. You can take that. And just do that.
I mean, really, but like, it's some of the stuff that they already did with No More Heroes 2, streamlining a lot of that stuff with doing like the NES games on the overworld map as opposed to exploring an actual open world.
Mm-hmm.
And then Travis Strikes Again is also just in its simpler nature. I mean, that doesn't have the combat isn't as finely tuned as it is in the 3D games, because No More Heroes is generally like top down or side scrolling.
Oh, here's another weird thing. Because like I'm scanning through my footage right now and I literally just remembered this. This might expose me as like a fake fan that didn't even really finish the game, even though I rolled credits and believe I finished the game. Like 50% of the world map is inaccessible, like to me at the end of the game. I'm looking at the world map and it's just highlighted. It's just highlighted in red with like one of those do not pass symbols. Like,
interesting.
Maybe I'm just an idiot and the comments are about to blow me up for not being a real gamer, but I don't know what to do.
Maybe it's like a Donkey Kong Country like fake credit sequence. Like, did you just turn the game off or did you let him play through to see if King K. Rool was actually dead?
I played through to the end and once it was like at a state of rest, then I turned off the game. And
have you played the game to a state of rest? That needs to be in our review policy. Like all reviewers must achieve state of rest.
Do you guys know of that Sega Genesis game where you have to press the Sega Genesis X-Men game where you have to press reset at a certain point in order to like
fuck?
Yeah. So I forget what like X-Men villain is, but it's like there's like computer terminal stuff. And you like beat them, and in order to get to the last level, it says something about like, oh, you need to reset the system or reset the software or whatever. So you have to hit the actual reset button on the Genesis.
That's some Hideo Kojima shit.
But yeah, and that was like 1991.
Yeah, this is why I feel so weird about writing this review, because like I look at this map that's literally half finished, and it's like. Like just the I played this game like I play any other video game. I didn't go for 100% or anything, but I didn't actively avoid doing side content. If I saw a side quest in front of me, I did it. And I don't remember seeing any side content that I skipped that would have unlocked it. So I don't know. This is why I feel like am I just stupid? Did I miss something? Why is literally half the map inaccessible after I've rolled credits?
That's the best part about reviewing games, is you see that stuff and you're like, nobody can help me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do about it.
I mean, we'll probably talk about it again later because we have more Skyward Sword listener mail as this becomes the summer of Skyward Sword. but there's things in that game that like I'm just like, wait, you do what now? Because I played that game before it came out on Wii and then never played it until the Switch release. There's like boss battles that were like way more arduous for me. And then like I go to it now and I'm like, man, what's the optimal path to do this? And I'm like, I never would have thought of that.
So no more Heroes fans. If I'm just an idiot that's wrong, I'm sorry that I've become that guy that plays Nier Automata to ending A and then says it was kind of shallow and I don't get the hype.
But you like the combat.
I don't want to be that guy. I know about that guy, but I can't figure this game out if there's more.
Maybe New Game Plus is just that other half of the map.
Oh, God.
Maybe you're only halfway through. Maybe you are at ending A.
That's, like, legitimately the anxiety keeping me up at night.
You got at least another day. Burn it down again.
You know, let me grab my Switch and just check the objective list after the credits. Let me just make sure.
Okay.
You do this live.
I did unlock a New Game Plus mode, and if that's where you get the other 50% of the map, I don't take responsibility for that.
Listen, those angry negative comments are still engagement. So make sure to say Travis instead of Travis in the review.
I feel like even though I'm pretty solid on how I feel about this game, it's the most difficult review I've had to write because I'm just scared that there has to be something that I'm missing and I just can't figure out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll find out.
Or it just sucks.
Will Matt survive the weekend? Find out on the next exciting episode of Connectivity.
So speaking of games that have a legacy that our reviewer did not experience, although this one seems a little more reasonable because I think this is the first time King's Bounty has ever shown up on a Nintendo system. But John, you reviewed King's Bounty 2.
I was really hoping that you were going to reveal that like Boyfriend Dungeon had this like this is like the 10th game in the Boyfriend Dungeon anthology. And I just totally missed out on it.
It's actually for the Super Nintendo.
Yeah,
it's actually Spelunky 34.
Yes. So I reviewed King's Bounty 2, which I remember like when trailers and stuff came out for it. It's a Western RPG with tactical combat. And I remember watching trailers for it and seeing like the overworld stuff and being like, well, that looks like something I might like. And then they would get to turn-based combat and be like, oh, but not so much that part. But nobody else wanted to review it. And I thought it was something that we should cover. So I reviewed it. And it's one of those, and I'm sure both of you guys have had this, where it's one of those times where I put the score on the game that I think is fair. I think I gave it a 6.5. And like, I think it's a fair score, but I also feel like I need to be clear that like, there are parts of this game that get really close to being good. it just makes a lot of like dumb quality of life mistakes that just get in its way more than they should.
Kind of like No More Heroes 3.
Yeah, I mean,
just
yeah,
a lot of like, self-inflicted wounds.
It's one of those things where it gets a lot of the complicated stuff right, and then there's just so many like, why do I walk at 1 mile per hour, and why is my horse only slightly faster but doesn't control well, and why are these dungeons so huge, and I can't call my horse in the dungeon, so I just have to slowly trot across the dungeons. It's stuff like that where it's the kind of stuff where it's like, did you guys ever play this game while you were making it and like just be like, oh, you should move faster. Like
I've played games like that where it's like you can imagine a very similar alternate universe in the Berenstain timeline where this game was good.
Yes. And yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of games like that.
Yeah.
I think the problem with games like that isn't that they didn't play it while they were making it. It was that they were the only ones that played it. Because they just got used to it and they didn't realize the problems. And then like someone else plays it and you're just like, hey, why does this feel bad? And it's like, what?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because and I know that this may sound like kind of a lazy journalistic thing to do, but the overworld segments of this game really want to be Witcher 3. And I don't just say that because it's medieval and it's open world and it's third person, but like even like a lot of the animations look like they pulled up Witcher 3 on one monitor and then just keyframed to match things. So it's weird to me that you would go to all that effort and then not realize that like Witcher 3 has a sprint button. and that's the other thing is so you move in this game very slowly and it has a button to change speeds, but it doesn't make you go faster. It makes you walk in case the incredible speeds you were already traveling at were just too much for you to control. It has a slower option, which feels like the game is actively insulting me.
Ooh, this feels like a PC game that had a lazy port.
I think it literally is. Yeah.
Because PC games have WASD instead of analog sticks, so the only way that you can walk is with a different button.
Right, but this would be way too slow for WASD as well. Because, like, I mean, I've played games like this on PC, and this is too slow. but then the other thing that this game struggles with is that, and this, once again, actually feeds in, Matt, to your comment about it being, the developers being the only people who played it. The combat is tactical combat, where you have different, like, each unit is like a squad of soldiers and individual soldiers can die off in that squad. And if an entire squad dies, that they're done. Like any experience points and leveling up that squad is gone. It's permadeath. And then you have to like go to a market and buy a new squad and start over with them, which is by itself a very brutal way to have the game work. Because if you do poorly, like you're going to have to spend money replacing that squad, and then because they'll be back to level one, they'll probably just die again.
That reminds me a lot of like the Darkest Dungeon does that, but like Darkest Dungeon is explicitly themed around like really bleak tones and just desperation and like being the person that decides to throw people into the meat slaughter, and I'm not sure if that's what this game's going for.
Yeah, and I think even to some extent, you know, something like, you know, you could say, you know, Fire Emblem, at least the classic ones, enforced permadeath and stuff like that. But I think what separates this one is that they don't really tell you how to play. And so you spend a lot of the early, like the first half of the game, going into combat and kind of just having to try things. Because essentially all they explain in the tutorial is, you know, here's how you move a unit. Here's how you attack. Here's how you use your special attack. And that's pretty much it. But all of these units have like a full page of stats and buffs and debuffs and abilities and strengths and weaknesses that it does not explain. And like there are sometimes implications that like the PR email for it was like, make sure you pay attention to your height advantage in battle. And I saw that after I've been playing the game for a while. I'm like, wait, is there a height advantage? And I'm like, so then I'm like in the game, I'm like, all right, if I attack from this hill, do I get extra damage? I don't know. Like, it's that combination of I don't know what I'm doing. The game won't tell me. There is no like separate. It's not like something where I can pause the game and go into the tutorial screen and like see more detailed information or even review old tutorials. Like, what they give you is what you get, and you get it once and then it's gone. And so for the first half of the game, I was just losing units constantly as I tried to figure out how the combat system worked, and then having to spend money to buy new ones. And so like every battle I fought was just impossibly hard because I was going in with all level one units, because I would just barely scrape by in the battle before that and have no units left and have to start over from scratch. So yeah, very punishing combat system. And it does that thing where, and I think, you know, I think they got a little bit better with this in the later Dark Souls games, but it has a little bit of the problem that I know the first Dark Souls game had, where if you die, it's not just that you go back to where you were, but you come back with less ability than you had before. So being bad at the game makes the game even harder, which is a game design concept I'm not a fan of. And this definitely suffers from that, where if me not knowing how to play yet actually cranks up the difficulty on the game and makes it harder for me to learn how to play, which is, I would say, evidence of the people who were testing it already knew what to do, and probably didn't have a lot of people who weren't already good at it trying it out. Because I think it goes beyond a little bit the whole get good thing and more into the like, no, you're actively punishing me for not knowing the rules of the game that you haven't told me.
Yeah, I don't like crap like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm fine with getting good as long as, yeah. And that's something the later
you
Dark Souls
like
games
have a
do.
Pathway. Yeah.
Yeah, the later Dark Souls games I think do a really good job of that, where they say get good, but you know all the rules. Like,
yeah.
So when you get screwed over, it's fair because they told you everything you needed to know.
And it's also, so I noticed some of the comments to your review, it's like people that are familiar with King's Bounty 1 that are just kind of like, well, like your issues with it, that's just King's Bounty.
Sure.
And it seems like the same kind of thing, whereas the difference between like King's Bounty and Dark Souls is that like Dark Souls is an extremely popular and vibrant series that has been, you know, inspired a lot of different games, and like a lot of the concepts and ideas of Dark Souls have permutated and got baked into the gaming language.
They're kind of in vernacular at this point.
Yeah. And King's Bounty, I mean, I'm not not the biggest PC gamer. I know I've heard of King's Bounty before, and it's got, sure, you know, classical 80s and 90s hooks and everything. But it's not part of the canon in the same way that Dark Souls has made it. So
yeah,
some of the eccentricities just, you know, haven't made it that like we're familiar with them. And it seems like the game might be expecting you to be aware of those eccentricities in the same way that like I notice when people like it's why I think like Breath of the Wild is so successful at being welcoming to newcomers, is that I think a lot of those Zelda games, you know, between like 2000 and 2011 or whatever, a lot of them spoke the Zelda language, didn't necessarily like reteach it. It was like you played Ocarina, so you kind of know the flow of this game, whereas Breath of the Wild threw that all out and was like, here's something totally new.
And I think there's a fair middle ground you can walk there, where, oh, you know, you could start at the beginning of this game if you wanted to have a thing come up and say, hey, are you familiar with the previous game? And if I said yes, they'd say, great, here's the basic controls, have fun.
Yeah.
But if I say no, then it's like, all right, sit down for a second.
Yeah.
Because like this is a deep, complex,
yeah, you're gonna need to
tactical
know some things,
RPG man. System that I need to teach you. But yeah. So as I said, to highlight some of the net, like I think the world is cool. I think the story is good. Voice acting sucks, but that's fine. And like the side quests were interesting, and I'd get pulled into side quests because, you know, most of a quest would be, you know, talking to people and running around the world doing things, and then at the end of the quest there would be a fight. And so I mentioned in the review, like, I have this long list of side quests where I've done all the story parts, And then I would get to the fight, see the other army and go, oh, I can't beat them, and just walk away from the side quest and never finish it. Because I was engaged in the story of the side quest, and then I would get to the combat and be like, oh, I don't want to do that. There's a lot of good in there. The music is good. The world is good. Switch port's rough, but I'm sure on other platforms it looks a lot nicer. I'd be interested in King's Bounty 3. That's if we can learn some things for the next one.
Make some improvements.
In another 30 years, then I'll be interested.
I got two review games, both my reviews hit this week. The first one is the game that I like. Both Boyfriend Dungeon and Spelunky 2 are pretty great games. I guess, you know what, I'll hit Spelunky 2 kind of quickly. And I know, Matt, you've played Spelunky 2, correct?
Yes, I have. Let me actually check real quick. I have 12 hours in Steam, which is way lower than I thought. But I, yeah.
The runs are very quick and they feel longer. Like, yeah, I've noticed really that where are. I'm like, oh my God, I'm sweating. And I'm like, that was like 15 minutes. Okay.
But yeah, I've put some time into it on Steam and I like it a lot. It had the misfortune of I also started playing Hades at almost the exact same time.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And I feel like that's actually, you know, our Spelunky 1 review. I was kind of the one being like, hey, man, you got to make sure you don't just crap all over Spelunky 1 to our reviewer, Joshua Rubin. And because he played it and kind of was like, felt like this was kind of too simple to what roguelikes have become, you know, kind of referencing Hades as like, this is a better, a more evolved version of that kind of game. Not that like, I have so many good memories of playing Spelunky 1. It's, you know, fantastic game, really foundational for how video games are, how indie games are, and that, like, it kind of set the path forward for all of the millions of roguelikes and roguelike platformers that came out since. You know, very, like, smart in how the procedurally generated levels are set up. So many secrets, really good jumping, just, like, good mechanics, very thoughtful. Super fun to just play runs of. And I feel the same way about Spelunky 2, in that, like, it's just fun to mess around with. There's so many secrets, like, even more. But I think this weirdly comes into some of what we were talking about with Metroid 2. And that whole AM2R, Samus Returns thing of, like, do I want just more of what was good before, or do I want something brand new? And I don't think it's that I was expecting Spelunky 2 to be like, oh, now it's a shoot 'em up. But you could have, like, called this Spelunky 1.5. Like, that's kind of how I feel about it. Like, there's new stuff there, but it's also, I feel like it's more hidden, just by the fact that there's, like, oodles of branching paths. Like, I think there's, like, I'm trying to think of, like, how many different, like, worlds and stuff there are. I think it's, like, 16. There's so much. I've not seen it all. I'm never going to do the eggplant crap. But like, there's so much to do, so much to find, so much to see that you might not even really experience it for a while. And it also, it irks me that the difficulty of the game seems slanted way towards the beginning. I found that, like, the first area that you start in Spelunky 2 just seems way harder than the first area in Spelunky 1. And even, like, the areas following up that first area. But once you kind of get over that hump, then, yeah, Spelunky 2 kind of opens up a lot. And there are new stuff, like there's a cloning gun that leads to some preposterous circumstances, and like there's more like NPCs that you can come across when you're in the different levels. And one thing that I haven't experienced that much of, but maybe Matt, we can try and do it. The online co-op seems like it would be incredible if it works well.
Yeah, I have played the online co-op on the Steam version, and it's actually like how I learned to play the game to a certain extent, because I have a friend that's very into Spelunky, and he was really smart about like letting me actually figure it out and learn and just kind of being there to help me with anything that I just was not able to pick up on my own. And then like I have another friend who like knew someone that just carried him to the end of the game and he didn't actually learn how to play. But I had a lot of fun doing that. So when you're playing Spelunky in multiplayer, it just becomes pure chaos.
Yeah, and that's kind of, I love that about it. And that's something about the game, is that like it's something that I actually was looking at some of what Derek Yu, like the guy who made Spelunky. If you haven't read the boss fight books Spelunky book, it's written by Derek Yu, and it's fantastic. It gives a lot of insight into the design of Spelunky 1, which, as previously stated, foundational for modern indie games. But some of like what they focused on with Spelunky 2 was not necessarily like they basically like looked to see what persisted, what made Spelunky 1 such a replayable game. And it was a lot of the daily runs. It was the sense of exploration, having all these different things you could find to do, how to separate more runs, like real emergent stuff. And I think some of that was also factored in with experiencing in multiplayer. I experienced it a lot, the original, of like playing with a friend, and we just kind of passed the controller back and forth, which was like a fantastic way to play through that game. And I think doing that online sounds absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It's the weird thing where I feel like I'm disappointed by Spelunky 2, but it's also like what I kind of wanted and expected. Like, it's just like the first one, and they added more insanity to it and kind of polished up some things.
Yeah, for me, it's really hard to comment on that specifically because I've never played Spelunky 1. I've only played Spelunky 2.
You don't have to.
So, like, most of the stuff that I would be like, if you were to ask me, like, what's great about Spelunky 2, I would probably name 100 things, and 99 of them you would say are just from Spelunky 1.
Yeah, because even, like, a lot of the level designs, and they do have a lot of twists on them, but it's like, you're still going through a cave, there's a lava area, there's jungles, like that's... A lot of the places kind of have like, oh, here's the Spelunky 2 version of that. They added a couple enemies. There's a different trap. And it is like it's still really, really good. And I'm definitely going to kind of settle into like what I did with Spelunky 1 on Vita when that came out there, where I will probably just play a Spelunky 2 daily run, every now and then just pop into it, because it's a game that just feels good. Even if I find myself somewhere in like the mediocre category with it, is that like I can reach end credits, but you're not going to see me doing all the bonkers secret stuff. But it's a chill game to play, even if it's absolute chaos and death and punishment. So,
and the important thing is that it doesn't have 40 Metroids to fight.
That is true.
I
haven't found all the secrets, so maybe there's a Metroid hiding out there somewhere. Who knows? One game that I'm pretty sure doesn't have Metroid, but definitely has its share of controversy, is Boyfriend Dungeon, which is a game that I don't know. Boyfriend Dungeon is really funny, and I think it's a great bit of combining a dating sim with a dungeon crawler where you date your weapons. Like, it is a supremely good hook that actually works throughout the length of the game. It's a game that does not outstay its welcome. You can probably roll credits in about five, six hours, like if not even really rushing, which is like the perfect length for this kind of thing, because a lot of it's bouncing between, there's an overworld map that you can walk around and go to different stores, go on different dates, talk to people, and then there's the dunge, as they call it in the world, where you go and it's isometric dungeon crawling action that's largely mediocre combat, but like it's not great combat, but it's not bad combat. So it's kind of like a thing that you do to break up some of the dating. And like, there's, it all feels good. There's a dodge roll. There's, light hits, special hits, stuff like that. But the charm of the game is in the writing and how they work in. Like, you have a cell phone that you can go to, and there are text messages that you can kind of send prefab responses to different characters and like engage with them there. Like, that's how you set up your dates and things like that. And I think when it gets to the controversial stuff, where I guess to summarize anyone who does not know, when this game came out, it was a shadow drop at the indie world. There was some hullabaloo shortly after it came out about there not being enough content warnings, about a character who, emotionally manipulates and, basically, I guess, spoilers, does like the I'm a nice guy thing. And then if you reject this character at all, just totally like turns on you and is a villain. Like, that's kind of the extent of what the character is. And I think that's largely the thing that people are referencing when they are upset about it. but in my opinion, I think it's just a really effectively well-written character that they like, they capture that vibe of the dude who's just like, oh, I'm such a nice guy. And you're like, well, I don't want to date you. And then he's just like, well, you're a fucking bitch.
A lot of the discourse that I saw seemed to come from people that believed that writing a bad, like a bad person as a character is an endorsement of their behavior.
Like, no, like that's like, he's the villain.
Yeah.
Like that's like, like I'm playing it. I was kind of, I kind of played the majority of the game like post controversy. So I had like my backup about it and I kept on waiting for it. I was like, oh, is it going to get worse? And like, granted, like I have not, you know, gone through that in a way that has completely shaped my life. I've definitely had my fair share of rocky relationships and people trying to guilt me into doing stuff and things like that. But you know, you can't account for everyone else's experiences. But it was just, it felt real, like the way that they wrote that character and the way that he interacts with you. Like it just, it's really well done. And I think that's part of the reason why it probably draws such ire is that they captured it well.
Yeah.
Cause I think we've all either run afoul of that nice guy trope or seen it happen to friends of ours where it's the person who's like super sweet and nice and then doesn't get what they want and then they're just a jerk.
I kind of feel like, so like just kind of how I am as like a person and what I believe in is that more content warnings is always good, but there's no realistic, reasonable way to have a content warning for everything that could use a content warning. It's just not possible.
Day one, before everything, there was a content warning. It just, I think the sticking point was it said, you might run into this as opposed to you will. And yeah. It's kind of it's not a thing you can really skip.
And this is what I feel, and this is about to move a little bit away from video games and a little into the discourse, like not this discourse, the discourse trademark symbol. I think it's just like this is an indie developer that clearly did care about that. Like they included not only that content warning, but also an optional switch so that if you have a bad relationship with your parents, you can turn off the encouraging texts from your mother in that game. Like they clearly actually care. And that's why this controversy gets applied to this game, because this is someone that will listen and care and be hurt when I tell them that they messed up. If we go to Atlas and say, hey, that stuff in Persona 5 was kind of fucked up, they're not going to care. If you go to the developer of Boyfriend Dungeon and say, hey, this reminded me of a traumatizing event in my life, is that what you wanted to do? The developer of Boyfriend Dungeon is way more likely to be like, oh, no, yep, I did not want to do that. I am sorry. So they are someone that is, they're more likely to get targeted, even though they clearly cared more than Atlas did. So I see this entire controversy as erroneously vilifying the people that are clearly trying to do right by this exact thing.
Yeah,
no one is immune from criticism. It is perfectly fair to say this content warning should have been better, but that's not what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they improved it. They already, I don't know if the update got pushed to Switch. I don't remember if an update came in for my, but I know like that on Steam, I think it's all updated. Nintendo sometimes takes a little while to get patches up. But yeah, like, I mean, aside from that, like Boyfriend Dungeon's really good. I guess kind of to wrap it up a little bit, there is one thing that kind of bugs me, but like I totally understand, but it still is super noticeable. It is a game that was a successful Kickstarter release, so they had stretch goals, and at a certain point the stretch goals and content that they had planned was like way over scoped for, you know, the feasible getting this game out anytime soon. So there's bits where it's just like you meet this character and he's like, yo, we should hang out, and literally the next scene is that guy being like, I'm actually going to be gone all summer, bye. And then I went and like poked around online and it's like, oh, he's coming out as DLC in the future. apparently they have two characters that are queued up, and there might be some more stuff as well. But like that, it just felt super noticeable. And, you know, it seems like stuff's going to come out, like, you know, the developer Kid Fox Games, you know,
feels like half the map was just like covered in red.
Yeah, no, pretty much. Maybe there's a new game plus that unlocks this. But it is the kind of thing that like it just stood out to me. like it kind of took me out of the game that I was like, oh, okay, like that's this is it. They couldn't finish this in time for, you know, the launch date that they wanted to hit. But what's there is really good. And like they have a nice variety of even weapon types. There's like a lightsaber, of course, it's like a person in like a K-pop band or something. There's a cat. You can't actually date the cat, but you can like go like hang out with the cat and pet it, and that's how you like level them up. And the cat's brass knuckles as a weapon, which just seems a little fitting. And yeah, and like all the individual stories for you can like date every character in one playthrough, so you don't need multiple save files or anything. And all the individual stories are, you know, interesting and fun, a little surprising. It's a good game. I highly recommend it if the idea of a dating sim dungeon crawler sounds fun. So, John, should we get to the Skyward Sword listener mail that is an essay?
Yes. Would you like me to read it?
Sure.
Gentlemen. Take a sip of my beverage here. So this is from James Troxel, who says, good morning, gentlemen. As promised, I've got my detailed Skyward Sword thoughts since you gents are the Skyward Sword Defense Force, and we're looking for thoughts of people who didn't like the Wii controls and if the regular controls make it more enjoyable. The short answer is yes. The long answer is below. I should just stop there.
The short answer is yes. Thanks for writing in.
just end it there. I'll give my thoughts on the game as best I can remember them from 2011 first. I hated the pacing. I thought the dungeons and dungeonification of the overworld was amazing, in particular anything to do with Lanayru. I hated the motion controls. I enjoyed Wii Sports Resort well enough, and even envisioned what a Zelda with those controls would be like, but in actuality I found it too inaccurate and tiring. In particular, the swimming and tadpole sequences seared into my mind as pure garbage. The game felt extremely padded. I vividly remember hating the imprisoned fights and the other recycled bosses. Were there other recycled bosses besides the imprisoned?
Like, you fight Girahim twice, but I don't really think those
could be.
Girahim gets, like, noticeably stronger and...
Yeah, because it's, like, the first boss versus, like, the second to last or whatever.
Yeah. I remember hating the sky part. I remember being disappointed by the story. Keep in mind, in 2011, the most recent Zelda game I would have played was Spirit Tracks, where Zelda is with you the whole time. Also, I can't help but wonder, since Game of Thrones was new and not played out then, if the culture pop from that made the more fairy tale style feel weak. I remember being massively disappointed by the music after the awesome trailer song. Also, again, this is after Spirit's Tracks, which had very good and unique music. Also, I felt it needed voice acting. At the time, I felt like half the time I was playing, it was the best Zelda ever, and the other half the time, it felt like the worst game that I had ever played. That's how Matt feels about No More Heroes 3.
Yeah. Skyward Sword, No More Heroes 3, the same game.
So, Neil, you might like No More Heroes 3.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, you should review it. Give it a 10 out of 10. Right off, this is in 2021. These are the modern thoughts. Right off the bat, the second stick helps a lot. The controls feel a bit cluttered, but it's accurate enough to rarely cause frustration. I actually don't mind the L plus stick to camera. I still think the dungeons are amazing, except by the time you get to the final dungeon, it feels a bit recycled idea-wise. I don't remember what the final dungeon was.
Skykeep.
Is that the one that was like the sliding puzzle?
But it's kind of like a greatest hits of a lot of the other dungeons.
I just remember not liking that one because I'm racist against sliding puzzles.
I like sliding puzzles, so I kind of liked it. But I don't think it's the best dungeon in the game.
No, but that's not, I mean...
That's a good dungeon, though.
Yeah. In particular, anything to do with Lanayru is probably the high point of the franchise. Ancient Cistern is the only good water dungeon in the series. They really make you use your brain and use the items in interesting ways. Plus, you really do have to keep using items in each dungeon. My only complaint would be that the dungeons are a bit short. It makes me really sad they moved away from this formula because they did it so well here. Give me traditional dungeons again. It's my favorite part of the series.
Hear, hear.
Yes.
I'm ready to throw down with people that disrespect the water temple.
Let's back it up. So what's your water temple defense? I don't think it's as bad, but I just want to
We're talking
hear
N64 water temple, right? Like Ocarina of Time?
Yes. Okay. So legitimate criticism is that on the N64, it really sucks to go into the pause menu and swap the iron boots And yeah. So the 3DS made it a one button equipable item, and now that dungeon is perfect.
Yeah, no, no, I agree with that.
Wrong with that dungeon, period.
I can definitely see it's a little confusing to go through the shifting water, but that's also like part of the point of the dungeon. I think the little like helpful delineation that they made in the 3DS version is fine. I don't think it was necessary.
The one part in that dungeon that I consistently had trouble with is there's one part where it's like while you're raising or lowering the water or something, there's this one little area with a bombable wall that I felt like the camera was just designed to never look at.
I just
never see it. And then I managed to happen to get the camera facing that way as I'm doing something and go, oh, there's a bombable wall over there. Okay.
I think I know that. I know the spot that you're speaking of.
But yeah, that's the only part of that dungeon that I really have an issue with. And that might just be me being bad at it in a very consistent way.
I think Ancient Cistern is maybe the best.
Ancient Cistern is incredible, especially like the because it's all like happy and beautiful and bright the whole time. And then suddenly zombies. There are zombies.
Oh, yeah. I did not mean that as a knock against the Ancient Cistern. It's a really good dungeon. And it's a reference to classical folklore, which I'm all about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an incredible. I mean, yeah, the whole game is just every time I get into a dungeon in Skyward Sword, it's just like this is great.
Yeah, I will say the one part upon my replay, I think the sand ship is a little overrated. I think it's the first time you experience the sand ship, it's amazing, and then it's kind of like, oh yeah, now I know this dungeon's coming up, because when you go there before, it's like that I'm exploring, where's the dungeon, and then you're like, oh hell, I'm in the dungeon, baby.
I just like anything with the time stones, I think is cool. And the Switch version makes the time stone stuff a lot smoother. Because the fun fact that I learned from noclip.website, the way Skyward Sword does all that time stone stuff, I would have originally thought that it was swapping out textures, but it is swapping out the entire model of the world. are two instances of the geometry that exist at any one time, and it's swapping between them.
Oh yeah, because some of the changes are too complex for just textures.
Yeah,
right. I just figured that like the basic geometry was the same, and then they were like loading in some other stuff on top of that.
That's wild.
But yeah, no, it's so yeah. That's why like on the Wii version, when you do those big time stone changes, the Wii kind of chugs a little bit because it's like just totally swapping
your
out
Wii dies
what
a little
is
inside.
There. Anyway,
yeah, let's get back to James.
The dungeonification of the overworld is awesome the first time through. For the forest sections, the revisits are still bad, especially the tadpole sequence, though it's more tedious than frustrating with regular controls. I actually like the goblin jailbreak sequence this time around. I remember hating it the first time. I'm still cool with the revisits. I think they change enough.
I think weirdly, and it's also in his 2011 thoughts, he referenced the swimming controls being pretty bad, and I do think like that makes it's the precision that's needed in the tadpole sequence that makes the motion controls really tough for that. I actually think that I think the swimming controls in Skyward Sword are actually pretty good, especially doing them on the buttons. Like really surprised at how easy that was to do, and it did make that to James's point. The tadpole sequence is definitely like it's less obnoxious. It's just like, okay, I got to do this, as opposed to like having trouble with actually executing it. Goblin jailbreak also does rule.
I don't mind the sky this time at all. It's minimal, but it's kind of fun getting the chests.
Yeah, that's how I feel about the sky. It does suck. Factually, it's not good, but you don't really need to do that much.
It doesn't hurt it. It's only its main crime is that it's too big.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just flying from point to point takes a while.
The reason that people see the sky as such a big problem is that like it was a big selling point. Like they made a big deal of it.
There was a marketing push about like, look at it, it's gonna be like exploring over worlds, and it's like, nah, there's just like a couple islands you can do stuff on, and the other ones it's like a chest might appear when you hit a stone in the underworld.
I have this vague hope, based on what little we've seen of Breath of the Wild 2, that maybe it can deliver on a cool sky.
Yeah.
What if there's as much sky in Breath of the Wild 2 as in Skyward Sword?
I mean, there's a consistent amount of sky everywhere. Yeah. It's just as there's stuff in it.
Yeah.
Let's see. The pacing doesn't bother me this time around. Skyloft's slow start is quicker, but I also feel the intentionality in it this time. There is still no story during dungeons 4 through 6, and it's weird after so much in 1 through 3, but that's okay. I like the story well enough. I still think it feels a bit underwhelming, but it's charming. It is certainly better than Breath of the Wild. 100% agree. Breath of the Wild's story was
not the best.
Yeah. The backstory of the world was told well, but like the story of that game was pretty boring.
I think that, I mean, Breath of the Wild is one of those things where, yeah, you learn a lot just by exploring through the world.
Yes. And that's the environmental storytelling of the history of the world is great.
Yeah.
But like the story of Link and Zelda could not be less interesting.
My one defense of Breath of the Wild story is that I think it's an interesting way to execute a video game story where, honestly, totally optional. You don't need to find the memories.
Yeah.
And looking for the memories is a puzzle. And I could definitely hear the argument that like the reward of like, it's the thing where he's looking at Zelda's butt. And that's weird. Why did I go to this mountaintop to find a memory of me looking at her butt?
That's what the replay feature is for.
but like a lot of those memories and how you get
sometimes
them.
Sometimes I forget that was actually in the game and not just in fan art.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It is in the game.
It's weird.
It's very in the game.
But I like how like you can find them out of order and like some of it might not make sense. And then you can kind of look at everything and it's in order. Like, yeah, you know, the actual plot that's there might not be that compelling. You know, some of the execution might be lacking, but I think the idea of that's how you find the story, the backstory of how Link and Zelda got to that point, I think that's really cool. It's just that, you know, the actual writing and plot maybe could be better.
Yeah. He says, I still think this game needs voice acting. I have mixed feelings about the music. It's great in dynamic moments, but boring in the normal moments. I think this is actually one of my favorite Zelda soundtracks.
I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's definitely like it ain't far behind.
It's up there.
Yeah,
it's very good. I've lived around people that just say it's bad for so long. It feels so good to have people praise the Breath of the Wild soundtrack. No, Skyward Sword.
Oh,
fuck.
Yeah.
No, oh, fuck. Yeah, I'm no, sorry. Breath? I'm trying out New Game Plus in No More Heroes, so I don't know what I'm talking about. I want to be able to report on like, oh, after the first boss, it gives you a new objective.
Skyward Sword's music is great. Yes. I can definitely hear somebody being like, I prefer this one more. That's fine. It's just, I don't
like the story. I think the music is better than Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
Skyward Sword is like, probably best music in the franchise.
Things that I still find infuriating and why, despite the really great moments, this remains my least favorite 3D Zelda. Though it's nowhere near as far behind as the second to last as it was initially. Got it. It's catching up. I almost bumped it to second from the bottom. That's how much my feelings improved. The recycled bosses are frustrating. I don't think Yerahim is a good villain. Hard disagree, but I'll allow your opinion.
Yeah, man, I want my villain to lick my ear.
I think Yerahim is one of the best villains in the series. Because, like, he's an actual character.
Yeah. He's not just an entity floating around.
And he's like enjoyable.
Yeah, he's like, he is like a really entertaining villain. I want my villains to be as over the top and stupid as possible. I want my villains to be theater majors. That's why Pirates of the Caribbean is good.
He's weirdly well written for a Zelda villain.
I do think his conclusion isn't as satisfying, but I think everything else up to that point is great.
I do enjoy the twist of his conclusion.
Yeah.
Like I enjoy, I'm saying this without spoilers, but I enjoy finding out like who he is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I like the way that works and did not see it coming.
I think it robs him of a little bit of agency. Like even if he was always going to be a servant of a greater power, it feels like less of he's choosing to do that and more it's just his nature. So I do kind of agree that the twist is a bit of a letdown, but Ghirahim's really fun.
Yeah. He says he feels like a poor imitation of better madmen like Kuja, Kefka, Sephiroth, etc.
Sephiroth's
I don't like any of these characters. Sephiroth and Gear Him
are nowhere near each other.
Yeah.
What?
Kefka. I'll take the Kefka. That's a fair comparison.
I would like Final Fantasy VII better if Sephiroth was just Girahim.
Yeah.
You might like Final Fantasy VII Remake then.
You might.
Yeah. Another Final Fantasy VII Remake. Let's see. His fights are just dragged out. All the fights in this game feel dragged out. It was super disappointing fighting him again at the end of the Fire Sanctuary. That dungeon was cool and deserves a unique boss fight that fit the
theme. Oh, you fight him that quick?
I think you fight him three times over the course of the game.
Yeah. Okay. Because there's the end of the first dungeon, like the Earth Temple or whatever. And then when you go to the second time you go through the Elden area. Then the
okay, I'm starting to agree with the criticism a little more. I think fighting him at the beginning of the game and the end of the game is 10 out of 10, but having him in the middle too is...
I forgot about the Fire Sanctuary boss, and I even like played that last month.
I don't mind it, but I have a whole video already on the YouTube channel on why I think that stuff is okay, so I won't go into it here. Fighting the scorpion randomly in the desert with no reward is egregious.
Well, no, it's a really easy boss fight. It's fine.
I think it's fine.
Why
is it a cool mini boss?
Why do you need a reward for when like a monster attacks you and you need?
Maybe
to
you should just do it because it's the right thing to do.
I will say so that part is kind of funny because you're like, oh, I'm looking for this thing, and then like you go like maybe it's in this room, and the scorpion's there, and then Fi at the end of it's just like, oh, it's not here.
Yeah. My calculations indicate we might be in the wrong place. All right, fuck you, Fi. He says, the imprisoned is still dreadful. The fact that you have to do it three times is maddening. The last time was particularly terrible. I will just add, those boss fights aren't hard.
Your video, maybe. So your video, John, did turn me around into being like, okay, I can appreciate this fight recurring.
Like,
I
don't think it's
feel
a good
like
fight.
It wasn't good the first time either.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't think it's like it's not an incredible boss fight by any means, but I appreciate kind of what it's doing. And the fact that it's not a super difficult boss fight, especially once you realize you can just ignore his toes, makes it
like mind blowing. Legitimately mind-blowing.
Yeah, I don't know that there. You might have to hit his toes once, but I think you might be able to do all three without ever touching that boy's toes.
That's a weird sentence out of context.
It's a weird sentence in context, honestly. But he says, the recycling just feels self-indulgent. I don't know how else to describe it. I really hate the last two bosses. They require a Souls level of precision without Souls level of gameplay quality. It's just irritating and not fun and leaves a sour taste in my mouth at the end of the experience. I love the last two bosses of this game and the lead up to the last.
I think those last two bosses being difficult is good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I do kind of agree with the idea of it being like almost a Souls level of precision. But I kind of like that because it's testing you on you know the unique controls that you had to learn over this 30 to 40 hour game.
I love, and it once another thing that runs better this time around. I love the charge down to Girahim through just the armies of Bokoblins.
I remember really liking that part, like even back then. And like
there had never been anything like that in a Zelda game where it's just like
so
Link
epic.
Against an army.
There's
and he's
like
just charging down to save Zelda. It's so good.
So like this game came out around the same time as Saints Row the Third, which decided that the entire final mission would play to I can't remember if it's Bonnie Wright or Bonnie Tyler, but holding out for a hero. The first thing that me and my friends noticed was like, hey, this fits with that section in Skyward Sword really well.
Yeah, it would. It would. Let's see. I also hate the Silent Realm sequences. It's so irritating. It was the most reviled part of Twilight Princess. I just don't understand how you hear 5 years of this part is the worst and say to yourself, let's keep it and make it even more annoying. just feels like padding.
No, because they fixed the bad parts about the Twilight Realm.
Yeah. Yeah,
they're also pretty short. I realized this time around.
The Silent Realm stuff's so good. Like,
they don't.
It's the one thing, whenever I hear people talk about it, it's just that, like, well, one, it's the second time you already went to these areas. You learned, like, how to explore these parts of the level. And,
which is literally the opposite of how it worked in Twilight Princess.
Yeah, Twilight Princess was the first time you get there. This is the second time around you go through these. And it's just this really nice tension of, like, you need to find these different things. It's pretty generous with, like, the stuff that, like, lets you see where the other stones or whatever you have to collect are, the drops of twilight. I don't think they're
tears of light. I think.
Yeah. That makes sense. You can, like, see where they are, you know. It's generally generous with, like, oh, you have 90 seconds to find the next one and you'll be fine. And if you do have that moment where you get caught, like the runaway to try to hide or avoid being caught is, like, just such a good tension. And
yeah,
I have the memory of what solidified these as being great for me, going through the Elden Volcano area. And I was looking for, like, the final one and couldn't find it. And at one point was basically just like I had, like, one of, like, the Dark Nut looking guys behind me just chasing me around as I'm frantically going through the map trying to, like, lose him when I can to find this last thing. And it's just, like, it was such a rush going through that. And I understand if I got caught there, I'd probably be like, fuck this, it's terrible. But I didn't. And I found the thing that I needed, and it was great.
And on it, I mean, none of them are very long.
No. Like, I did get caught my replay of the Lanayru one, where I think I either got the last one or I was, like, going back to where you have to, like, you know, finish it all up.
Yeah.
And I got caught and I was like, damn it. And I'm like, oh no, wait a minute. Now I can just do a really quick optimal route to just, like, collect the 10 things I need to collect and be done.
Yeah.
It took me probably 5 minutes.
Yes. So he says, I also think the game is really padded in general. The revisiting areas, especially every forest sequence, like replaying the entire first dungeon, it's just infuriating.
Replay the entire first
you just
dungeon.
Walk through it.
Yeah.
And most of the times when they have you do that, I think there's usually a bird statue at the end of it.
Okay, so I don't remember that part of the game well enough. And like I said earlier, I don't remember if we were actually recording by then, but I'm going to be playing Skyward Sword HD on stream relatively slowly, so I'm not that far yet. Do you actually have to redo any part of the first dungeon?
You walk through it pretty much in a straight line just to the boss room.
Yeah.
And there's, like, a couple, like, there's some new enemies there.
Yeah.
And
there's a few areas that you can explore because you get the ability to go underwater, and there's, like, a couple side rooms.
Yeah.
You go through, there might be, like, a piece of heart there, I forget.
No, it's okay.
It's just Metroid,
but all the puzzles are still solved.
Yeah.
By definition, you're not redoing anything.
Yeah, and it's also it's like the Silent Realm, where it's something that you already went through and you probably have memory of, like, oh yeah, I'm going back to this dungeon. Here's an area that is marked on the map, or, you know, has a door leading out of it.
And like we've said before, I mean, it's a Metroidvania. Like,
yeah.
you have a new ability. I'm going to go back to this area I was already at where I couldn't do this thing before.
I'm going to go do
that thing. And yeah, I have to walk through an area I've already been through. Okay. I think this could have been a near flawless 20-hour experience, but they dragged it out to avoid it's too short complaints. So
honestly,
probably not
unfounded.
Yeah, that's fair. So my conclusion is this game has the highest highs of the series, but also the lowest lows. So depending on your preferences, those lows will have more or less impact on you. For me, it was too much to enjoy it as much as I did the others, though there were moments that I loved it. I'm glad I replayed it and would advise those who passed on it or those who never finished it should replay it. Regardless, controls don't fix everything, but it makes it casual enough to enjoy sitting on a couch and not stressing about flailing your arms. The game deserves a better rap than it got, but it's still a mixed bag. Anyway, that's how I feel. Tell me why I'm wrong. We've been doing that the whole time.
Yeah.
Thanks
for writing in. Like, I appreciate your perspective because it is, we are the, you know, patent pending Skyward Sword Defense Force.
The Skyward Sword Federation Force.
Yeah. The Skyward, the SS, SF,
SSF,
But like, and
I feel like that's already an abbreviation for something.
Probably.
I'll look it up. You talk.
But it's the kind of thing where like I mean it's interesting seeing people who bounced off the game before.
It stops skeletons from fighting. We can't use it. They're too popular.
That's funny.
They make good videos.
They do.
But yeah, no, I appreciate the perspective on it. Even if there are parts of it that I totally disagree with, that's the wonderful thing is that, you know, people can have different opinions on games and it's fun, even if they're wrong about Super Metroid, John.
I am very excited to have Zach on my side for that. That is a relief that I will not be one man against the hordes.
But yeah, thank you, Matt, for joining us and telling us about No More Heroes 3 and playing it for the back half of the episode. looking forward to seeing your full review. John, thanks for being here, as contractually obligated.
Yes. I've also been working on things while recording this episode.
Yeah, we haven't even really teased that. Yeah, Star Fox Command, if you like it, keep an eye out to NWR TV. There's going to be a whole lot of stuff about it very soon.
Yes. It should be on Saturday.
Yeah.
For reasons, if you're familiar with dates.
Yes.
It's just a chest-high wall at the end of the map. That's all it is.
Oh, do you have a jump button?
Yeah, and I can't jump over it.
That makes
sense. All right.
Well, we solved that mystery. And we'll talk more about Star Fox Command next week. We can kind of recap the awesome thing that John is working on right now about it. And then maybe we'll talk about other games as well. I think, John, I haven't told you, but Zach might be coming on next week. He wants to talk about Quake.
Oh, okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I like
that. And Axiom Verge 2.
Oh. Got me with the Quake.
Write in your thoughts. They can be about Skyward Sword or other games as well, or other things at connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @connectivitynwr. And we'll be back next week with more take about Nintendo.